Did you continue doing any other work, or was
No, I was doing all the other work at the same time. So, fact of the matter is, I guess I always was involved about 7 days a week in whatever I was doing at that time, and. But it was an interesting thing, you know. I had gotten away from it completely. But I ran into some articles in some Russian journals here that had been translated to English just about 6-7 years ago. And, you know, some of the compounds that I was making back at that time were the things that the Russians were working on, and they were claiming that they were very broad spectrum antiviral agents and so forth. Now, whether they really were or not, God only knows. It was too late for me to get back involved in it, but so that's the way it went. But after Willard was gone, of course, there was no support.
Were there any other Dow employees working on this?
Well, just Jim Sheridan, and of course Sheridan left, and the company then was off on his own. God knows what he ever did after that. See? But he was an interesting guy. In fact, is he took his law degree while he was working on Dow, studied, and became a lawyer.
I have a list of a number of other things that you were directly involved with. I'm wondering if we could sort of go down the list and again look at, as you, we've
sure.
been doing.
I don't know how much time you've put aside for this today, of course.
Well, are you?
I have nothing particular.
Okay. You know.
We can go and have lunch somewhere at noon if you want.
I'm going to meet Ray at 2.
Well,
and
okay.
I thought maybe we'll see if we can go another hour perhaps.
Okay, fine. That's good as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
we'll see how. What
Benji.
let's see. We've talked about your chapter in the Bounty Boyer book.
Yeah. Well, you know, that to me, I think, is an opportunity. I think that Ray gave me there, I think, really was a extremely important, very key thing in my own career, my own self-confidence on developing as a scientist.
Did you get much contact from other professionals as a result of that chapter, from outside of Dow? Or you?
Oh, yes, yeah, sure. I had a lot of contacts over the years with professors as a consequence of that. In fact, Bob Simha used to tell me that you know, in the courses that he was teaching, that chapter on polymerization and styrene was required reading. But no, I do a lot of this with people.
The styrene divinyl benzene copolymers, some of those ended up being used in the ion exchange resin.
Oh, okay. Well, at the time, see, the Bill Bauman occupied the lab with Harold Robinson. And Bill became interested in the business of softening water by, or what was available at that time, I think, was called green sand. It was a packing in the very early water softening units that people used, and Bill got the idea that if he could attach the functional group to an insoluble polymer, that this would allow him to use that polymer as an ion exchange resin and to regenerate it by pouring the appropriate salt solutions, sodium chloride, down through it. So as it turned out, I was making these copolymers in rod form at the time. We had not done any bead polymerization at that point. And so Bill got a hold of some of the styrene divinyl benzene polymers and ground them up and sieved them and did his sulfonation, tested it for the ion exchange capacity. They looked pretty good to him. And in fact, they really started a major program on making them. And bead polymerization, of course, was already known at that time. And the logical way seemed to be to use suspension, so they very quickly went to making their copolymer by suspension polymerization. But they had proven successfully that the cast ground up rod would work. But as it turned out later on, you know, they found that our friend Delilio had upstaged him and patented the use of the sulfonated styrene divinyl benzene copolymer for ion exchange. Dow licensed it, and so it really was no great barrier to making it. But he was a shrewd guy, you know, Delilio. If you go back and read how much stuff he'd take, he apparently had that marvelous ability to read what people were describing as problems in the specs on their patents, and figure what he could use that for. And I'm sure that he must have written an awful lot of paper patents, but with tremendous intuitive, capabilities to figure what they would be good for. So Bill did that work, and it culminated in major success for Dow over the years. I think at first it was, I don't know whether it was Nalco or it was one of the companies that was involved in selling ion exchange systems that for water softening that Dow made a deal with, but in the initial phase of it. Of course, now, you know, they're able to make this monodispersed particles. I don't know if you're familiar with the work that Ed Tim has done. He has a system, of course, you know, you had the normal particle size heterogeneity in regular suspension polymerization. And Ed came along with a method of using a plate, base plate, in the bottom of a tank with colloidal stabilizer like methacel, and then pumping the styrene divinyl benzene monomer with containing the appropriate initiator through these small holes in that plate. And then he sonically excites this plate, and those bubbles come off there absolutely uniform, and there's enough colloidal stabilizer in the aqueous system to keep them uniform during the entire polymerization. So he can make completely monodisperse styrene divinyl beads, and they've had some very special uses. But that's types of resins that Dow makes today. But you know, Bill did so much work on then on separation of rare earths with these resins, and he worked on an awful lot of that ion exchange chemistry, and certainly is probably our best known ion exchange scientist that the company has had, although a lot of other people that came in later and did an awful bit of good job with Wheaton and Anderson, so many of those people.
When did you start work on foams? Did you do any urethane first?
Yeah. Fact of the matter is that after the war, when this group went to Germany and had access to the German manufacturing, DeBell, from DeBell and Richardson, Goggin, you ran into Goggin before, but another fellow by the name of Gluer, they went to Germany and studied the German plastics practice. They wrote a book on it, and it was published, I think, 1946. I'm not sure. Maybe I've even got a copy of it in my library here. I know I have at work. But I read that book, and I looked particularly at the urethane chemistry that had been done at Bayer. And I thought, my gosh, that's a tremendous opportunity for Dow. In fact, I've got reports back at that time where I identified all the active hydrogen compounds that we were making with multiple active hydrogens, the diamines, the glycols, polyglycols, and all that sort of thing. I said, boy, I said, this is a tremendous opportunity for Dow. And so at the time, I was able to buy toluene diisocyanate, both from Monsanto and DuPont. The DuPont material at that time was certainly a higher quality product than Monsanto's, but in addition to making the toluene diisocyanate, DuPont people also made the 1,6-hexamethylene diisocyanate. They had the 1,6-hexamethylene diamine for making nylon, 6,6 nylon, so they converted that with plastine to the carbamyl chloride and made the isocyanate. But I was able to buy those isocyanates at the time, and I made quite a variety of products, including some very primitive foams from those materials. And of course, I knew about it from reading the German information. Bayer had done a very nice job, I thought, his publications in the late 30s and early 40s when they came to light were very nice pieces of work. So as it turned out, I became very much interested in the opportunities for Dow in this area. And in 1949, Otto Bayer came over. And let's see, he had had connections with William Hale, Billy Hale as we called him. He was one of the early directors of the Organic Lab. In fact, he'd been brought here to direct it in the first place by old Herbert Dow, and married his daughter. You know, that was part of the... You probably read that part of the history of... But anyway, the buyer came here, and he wanted to have a joint venture with Dow on urethanes. So... I remember, because of I knew Billy Hale quite well because of my earlier connection. He was interested in that, in the possibility of these cancer drugs too, so I'd gotten to know him quite well. And I got invited to a cocktail party and a chance to talk with Bayer. Well, Bayer was pushing very strongly to form a joint venture called Dobe at that time. And the interesting point was that our people doing economics on isocyanate said, there's no way in the world you're going to nitrate and reduce and phosgenate and dehydrochlorinate and go through all those unit processes and finally distill and purify and make anything less than a dollar a pound. Now you look at it, 1949, my gosh, a dollar a pound ends like $20 a pound today, see. So the net result is they turned them down. I think something that always stuck in my mind, it's kind of amusing, was Mr. Bennett, the company treasurer at that time, when Bayer was here. We were making a lot of styrene, so we were cracking a lot of hydrogen off. So Mr. Bennett, he was, you know, very, very frugal with the buck, and he was most concerned about not so much about the new isocyanate and urethane chemistry, but about the what could Dow do with all the hydrogen they were getting from cracking ethyl benzene to make styrene. But see, that was his interest. I suppose that's why things worked out pretty well, is that he kept close control of the buck, and some of his bird in the hand was worth many more in the bush. But at any rate, just kind of amused me, I suppose, as a young chemist. But so I was only 29 years old at the time, and I said, well, there's a lot of opportunities there, but so it looks like it isn't going to amount to much. But this following summer, I had Frank Brower, who was taking his PhD at Michigan at that time, and he was a summer employee for me. And I told him, I said, well, I said, I guess that we aren't going to make it in urethanes here. But there's one thing I would like to have you do before we give it up. I said, Lee Horsley and some of the guys over in the Britain lab are making some polyols. And they're using, of course, base catalyzed reaction with different types of diol and triol initiators and so forth. And I said, up to now, the foams that are being made by Lockheed and others are using primarily hydroxyl terminated polyesters. For your summer project, why don't you get a hold of some of those polyols? And we've got some isocyanate. See if you can make some foams out of them. So Frank did, and you know, he did a very interesting piece of work. We didn't know much about catalysis. We used sodium peroxide as the catalyst, but Frank did that work, and he wrote the report on it at the end of the summer. I took him over to what was the organic chemicals group at the time, we're looking, presumably looking for opportunities to market something, and had Frank describe his summer work, and they looked at it, and that's interesting, you know, with no bites. So I had him, I applied for a patent. Well, he said, we ought to be a co-inventors. I said, I'd like to have you get your first patent yourself. And then I said, so you want it. And Frank did get, the very fact is probably the first patent on using polyols to make flexible foams. So it really didn't teach the critical things. It only taught that it was possible to make a soft cushion foam from polyols. We knew nothing about the chemistry of getting cells to open at the right stage by using the right balance of tin and and a mean catalyst. I'm putting him out just a minute. Ted, he probably wants to go out. I'll take this off. And
all right, I'll just shut this off.
So he really, while he supported the work, he still couldn't really implement much on it. So at any rate, we gave up at that point on urethanes. And then it turns out that that's just about the time that Turner and Ed Coward did the analysis on the styrofoam process. See, we had the old tower process that you've read about that, I'm sure. It was the tower process that was developed during World War II based on the old Munters patent, the Swedish inventor, that was granted in 1935. And it was largely Ray McIntyre, starting with Larry Amos, but followed up on by Ray McIntyre, that they made the old process that they fired out the logs of styrofoam from the old modified aniline reactors that had been salvaged during the war. See, and then, of course, initially that foam found some uses in on the troop ships to try to make life rafts and various things of that kind. The military used it. But at the end of the war, the whole thing went to pot. There was no civilian use for that kind of product. But I think gradually, of course, people started search for uses and found that maybe insulating, the thermal insulation would be a potential use. And of course there's where Loring Matheson, some of those folks came in, and he identified the cell size of the foam as being much too large for efficient insulation, and a lot of work went on at that point. But the point was that the people doing process economics and doing market studies said there's no use for that stuff. But Beebe was a champion in that case. I have to go back and say that it was because of John that new plant was built. But it was still a tower. It was still a tower process. But it did make some of the foam that was cut up and handled much like the old logs were in this era a century before. You know, and it was used for constructing beer cooler rooms and that sort of thing. And then along came the man I remember most was McCurdy. It was Lloyd McCurdy who came along and started to develop a continuous process for feeding polymer and blowing agent, nucleating agents to an extruder and developing the appropriate engineering, the appropriate equipment so that the mixing of the blowing agent and nucleating agents was facilitated when the polymer viscosity was hot enough for it to be low, and then being able to cool the gel to exactly the right temperature you needed when it was going to emerge from the dye to make a stable foam. But that's where Turner came into it, because at that point people knew that what was going on. You were putting the polymer through and mixing it under certain conditions and making a plank. But he and Ed Coward, who was an engineer at the time, got together and worked on it. Mostly Turner's ideas on the thing. Ed had provided mainly some of the engineering information. But he came along with that and presented it, and that's where I found it to be particularly interesting, because interestingly enough, when working with Boyer and working with styrene divinyl benzene copolymers, I'd done quite a lot of work for him on because of his interest in solvents for polystyrene. And we used to use the old equilibrium swelling of gels, to get what was called a fluorine mu value at the time, and was, of course, a measurement of how good a solvent that you had for the polymer. And so then that really was the thing that intrigued me, because when we started talking about the role of the blowing agent in making foams, I said, well, we had already known that permeability was a function of the product of diffusion and solubility coefficients, and so how a blowing agent was going to behave in a polymer seemed that, to me at least, that we ought to know what its solubility coefficients were. But we talk about things that are boiling 25, 50 below zero, that's measuring solubility by any techniques we had at that time wasn't that good. So I devised a technique to be able to use sealed systems and quantitatively measure the swelling of styrene divinyl benzene copolymers, and in that way I was able to characterize virtually all of the volatile organic compounds that might be considered as blowing agents for polystyrene foams. And generally out of that came a fairly coherent theory on blowing agent selections and what parameters you had to look at. And so I did a lot of reporting on that type of thing. But also at the same time, I got involved in looking at the effect of polymer structure on how some of these things formed. See, the interesting point was I had these cross-linked particles that I was swelling, and they were nothing but more than maybe quarter-inch diameter, quarter-inch long pieces of cast polymer. And you put them in a special piece of equipment, let them imbibe solvent till they come to equilibrium, and I was able then, with a proper capillary on there, to see how much solvent had been imbibed at that point. And what I noticed with some of these things is after I opened the vessel up, when I'd come to equilibrium, I'd take the particle out and I'd be able to weigh it and cross-check. But some of the samples, I'd put it on the desk, at room temperature, they'd foam up into expanded replicas of the piece that I started with. Well, that was for some of the better solvents like butadiene and SO2 and Freon 11. But then the thing was, I realized, here's other samples that haven't taken up quite so much, and their glass transition is still higher than room temperature, so all I have to do is warm them up and they ought to foam, and indeed they did. So this was really 1951 was my start of work on very shortly after Turner did his work on starting to try to make an expandable particulate of polystyrene. And at that time I was completely unaware that the Battersea was doing anything along those lines at all. But see, Battersea didn't have a continuous extrusion process, and they were looking for an entry into the expandable polystyrene. So, but at any rate, you know, I had these particles and was foaming them up. In fact, I published later on on pressurizing these polymers with carbon dioxide and foaming them. You know, if they were cast polymers, they formed expanded replicas of the original. The size very nice. I mean, they duplicate a piece and some expanded foam. In fact, I've published stuff on isotropic expansion of polymers too, and got some got quite a lot of work on that. But at any rate, the thing that I try to convince people, you know, I said, gee, you know, look at here, you got this particle of polystyrene, you just heat it to 105-110 degrees centigrade, and it puffs up 30-40 times the initial volume. Very nice cell structure. We got to figure some way of being able to heat that stuff up and mold and fuse it into coherent structures. And at that time, you know, I still believe that what you did was talk to your engineers and convince them that that would be a good project. And you might as well have talked to the moon, because no one took it up. And in fact, this was a big fiasco for Dow, as far as I'm concerned, because we were right there at the right time and did not put anybody to work on that phase of the problem. And Fritz Dastny in Germany went to work on trying to mold it and discovered the steam molding process, you know, and it really actually turned out to be extremely valuable to Battersea. In fact, it's an interesting point on that. We have a guy, an attorney who represents us on patent matters in Europe, and I met him about 10 years ago when I was in Europe, and we were talking about when he became an attorney and who he worked for, and it turned out that it was right at the time that Stastny did his work on steam molding. And he said he went to work for Battersea, and he'd never written a patent case in his life. So they dragged out Stastny's disclosure and said to him, well, we don't consider this to be a very important case, but why don't you practice on it? So he said he wrote Stastny's case, and of course it issued as a patent, as a U.S. patent as well as European. And the final analysis of it, Battersea made more money, according to Michael Hahn, on that one patent than they made on all other patents that they had combined. Mm. Now, it just shows you how really difficult it is to look at something in the early stages and accurately assess where it's going.